From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with some of the most important rappers and DJs of the past 30 years. Today we hear from Dave and Mace of De La Soul.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, tell me, mirror, what is wrong? Can it be my De La clothes or is it just my De La Soul? What I do ain't make believe. People say I sit and try, but when it comes to...
De La Soul started recording in the late 80s. Their sense of humor and irony contrasted with the hardcore rap that was popular at the time. Will Smith will talk about his first big hit, Parents Just Don't Understand. Instead of bragging about street cred, it talked about going shopping at the mall with his mother. And Queen Latifah will talk about recording raps in the late 80s that addressed the misogynistic bent of some of her fellow rappers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The rap group De La Soul made its debut in 1989 with an album that went against the grain of hardcore rap. That album, 3 Feet High and Rising, was not only fun, it was funny. It sampled a wide range of music from Liberace to George Clinton and even included comedy skits. De La Soul helped form Native Tongues, a loose alliance of New York-based alternative rappers, including Queen Latifah, who we'll hear from later, A Tribe Called Quest, and the Jungle Brothers. In 2000, I spoke with Dave and Mace of De La Soul. They founded the group when they were still in high school and were discovered by DJ and producer Prince Paul. Let's start with a track from their debut album. This is 3 is the Magic Number.
That's a magic number.
Three.
Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
Three.
Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born 3, Mace Dub and me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music, racing 3 parts. Casually see, but don't do like a soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk.
Three.
Parents let go, cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap, shows you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase and Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Do-Si-Do's your daughter. A tri-camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy Productions. It stands for the inner sound. Y'all and y'all can bet that the action's not a trick, but show me the function. Everybody wants to be a DJ, everybody wants to be an MC, but being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. De La Soul Posse consists of 3, and that's the magic number. This here piece of the pie is not.
I asked Dave and Mace if they had any reservations about recording an album that was so different from the hardcore rap that was popular at the time.
No, we weren't afraid. I mean, that's really where we come from. That's what we knew. So that's what we knew to implement in our music.
It was an innocence. We paid no mind to what was happening on around us. I mean, you know, the people that we admired and looked up to were the Run DMCs and the Public Enemies and the
LL Cool J's
and KRS-One's. And, you know, none of these groups sound anything alike. You know, everyone was doing their own thing. So to step into the game or even try to introduce ourselves to the game was like, okay, well, we're bringing our own thing to light also. And there was an innocence there that you know, paid no attention to fads, what was in, you know, what was selling and what was not and what wasn't. It was just, you know, a couple of kids just getting together and having a good time and giving a product to a company that had bigger plans for it, you know, and that's where it was with us. So, I mean, to sit back and really analyze the situation and say, wow, are we going to make it? Is this going to be accepted or what have you? That was no concern of ours.
What's the range of reactions you got to that first CD, which was filled with humor and irony, and we'll get to this later, with samples from just all kinds of different music?
I mean, people loved what we did. I mean, I have to honestly say that's my favorite and probably will be the best album that I felt like we've ever done. Like I said, there weren't any boundaries. We were just some young kids having a good time, and people respected it for that. It was like, wow, these guys aren't really, you know, afraid to give themselves 100%, whether you thought it was childish, whether you thought it was funny, or whether you thought it was ingenious. It was just, you know, people accepted it. It was always good to hear, you know, the toughest of the tough, you know, the gangsters, the, you know, someone like a KRS-One at our first release party, you know, like just praising us, like, wow, De La Soul, you guys are incredible, this is crazy. Or it was good to see those people that, you know, went out and bought records, you know, for years, just loving what we did. It was excellent.
Did you think anything was misinterpreted?
I think the only thing that maybe was misinterpreted, that people kept classifying us to be hippies, you know, when we didn't really have an understanding of what that was all about, you know.
I wonder how much
cool.
of that just came from the design on the album jacket.
Yeah,
which
had,
like,
came
daisies
from the design.
On it. And, uh-huh.
Yeah, people misinterpreted the look, you know. I mean, I think people thought that we were going out trying to, I guess, advertise ourselves as, you know, this fun-loving, you know, 60s hip-hop group. And I was born in the late 60s. I knew nothing about, you know.
I'm a 70s baby, you know, myself. So,
I think that's the only thing that kind of, like, got at us, where it was like, you know, when it came down to publicity and advertising the record, people always wanted us to take pictures with flowers and make sure you wear yellow and lime green. And, you know, it's like, you know, well, I want to wear brown today, you know. So it was that kind of a thing that was kind of a bit annoying.
The samples on that first CD included Steely Dan, Liberace, Otis Redding, the Jarmels, who did a little bit of Soap. Stand By Me, I think, is sampled on it, the Benny King record. Mm-hmm. There's a French mm-hmm. language instruction record. How did you know all these records?
Parents' record collections.
Yeah.
That's really what it was. I mean, I was kind of hung up in the funk era and reggae era with my parents and my uncles and stuff. And
my parents were listening to Perry Cuomo, Liberace, really? Sammy Davis Jr., and, you know, stuff like that. And
Pa's parents have a real strong Southern background.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they listened to a lot of Otis Redding.
And yeah.
You know, a lot of stuff that was on this popular station called ABC back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Home of the Good Guys. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Where we got, you know.
And then, of course, Prince Paul, who collected stuff like Multiplication Rock and Mickey Mouse Records and, you know, all sorts of kiddie records like that. So just, you know, the everybody bringing their fourth into it made 3 Feet High and Rising what it was.
So these are records that you really liked, even if you liked some of them for being really bad? I mean, for just really being so awful that they were fun?
Oh, yeah. You're always going to find something. It's not every record. I mean, there are a lot of records that are in our crates that, you know, are just like, you know, just for one thing. But that one thing makes it special. That Liberace record.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna sit here and say that I listen to Liberace all day. But, you know, so that introduction was just incredible, you know, and that worked for De La Soul. It was like, you know, that had to go on the record.
Well, I think we'd better hear the Liberace sample.
All right.
And now for my next number, I'd like to return to the classics. Perhaps the most famous classic in all the world of music. World of music. World of
music. World of music. The first time around, you didn't quite understand our new style of speak.
Don't worry, we can fix that right now.
So why don't you all just grab your bags?
Come on board, hoist the anchor, we'll be off.
Plug two.
That's from De La Soul's first CD, 3 Feet High and Rising. My guests are two of the three members of the group, Dave and Mace. So when you started sampling, I'm wondering if you started shopping for records in a different way than you ever did before, just looking for cool things to put on your own records.
What's so funny, the method of shopping for records was kind of like really different. I mean, and it's like that for a lot of hip-hop artists. We sometimes are clueless of the artist and what music they play and what instruments or what type of music it is. We're looking at a couple of things. We're looking at the year. We're looking at what instruments are being played. We're looking at the font on the record. If it looks like it's psychedelic, that might have something different. If it looks jazzy, it might have, you know, we're looking at a lot of other things more than who the musician is and what the songs are.
After your first CD, you were sued by the Turtles for sampling something from one of their records. What was the outcome of the suit?
It was settled.
Settled out of court.
It was settled out of court. Unfortunately, what happened was the record 3 Feet High and Rising was, there was a demand for it, and the rush was there to get it in stores. And, you know, we turned in all sample information and what we sampled and what we needed cleared. And unfortunately, the record label just didn't take its time out to, you know, to hash out all business prior to putting the record out. So the sample clearance thing never happened, and the record obviously took off. And rightfully, you know, the Turtles came back and, you know, sued us for, you know, not clearing the sample. That's fine. That was cool. But we did settle it out of court, and all is well.
My guests are Dave and Mace of De La Soul. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dave and Mace of the rap group De La Soul. Here's another track from their first CD, 3 Feet High and Rising.
Greetings, girl, and welcome to my world of phrasing right up to bat. It's the Daisy Age, and you're about to walk top stage, so wipe your lottos on the mat. Hip-hop love, this is, and don't mind when I quiz your evolvements before the sun. But clear your court, cause this a one-man sport, and who's better for this than Plugged One? Don't have to worry about me squashing other deals, cause they've already been squished. Freeze the frame of our moves the same, wish we can continue right behind the bush. You'll stay with me, I know this, but not because of all my earthly treasures, or regardless to the fact that I'm past the noose, but because...
How do you think your experiences growing up in Amityville, Long Island, which is a suburb of New York, compared to the experiences of some urban rappers who ended up doing more, you know, hardcore kind of raps?
It's a different upbringing. I mean, Long Island and especially Amityville gave us the opportunity to not, you know, not be around maybe all the inner city elements, you know, schoolyard and
that was just back then.
Yeah.
Nowadays, Long Island is not that much different from the
city. Yeah, it's not that much different. Mm-hmm. But you know, whether you're dealing with you know the next person on top of you and projects and you know it's overcrowded or what have you, you know, you had a single family home, your own bedroom, a big backyard to play in, and you know, you did things like went to Tanner Park and went fishing, or, you know, you...
It's just room to be an individual.
Yeah, room to breathe, room to get, you know, just to see different things.
Did you ever go through a phase of trying to pretend like you were from, you know, an inner city background?
Well, no. Myself and Dave both lived in Brooklyn at one time.
Yeah, I mean, it was a part of our lives regardless. We got the best of both worlds. You know, we had the opportunity to see the grimy part and, you know, appreciate, you know, getting out of the hood. You know, a lot of rappers nowadays will represent the hood to the fullest. And I'll be honest, I don't want to represent the hood. I want to get out of the hood.
I want to get out there.
So it's like, you know, we've seen the best of both worlds. And I think it's important, you know, as a young black male, to get to see both worlds, because you're going to have to be a part of it in life regardless. You're going to be put in that position where people think that that's where you're from anyway. So it's not a problem knowing it, and nor are we ashamed to be a part of it. You know, it's just sickening when you hear those who act as if that's the best place to be. I'm proud of being raised in Long Island, part of my life.
I think I'm doing the community a service by getting out.
Yeah, right. And plus, on top of that, I mean, now that we're fathers, you know, Long Island is cool. It's not the best as it used to be, but it just motivates me to know if my parents got me out of Brooklyn, then I can get my kids out of Long Island. And that's all it's doing for us and it's done for us.
I'm wondering if either of you had parents who were very political, and not necessarily voting booth politics, but just in terms of having a kind of political, social analysis of class and race in America, and if they talked to you a lot about that.
I think we grew up with parents who just, you know, had, you know, moral backbone. It was like, you know, I'm not sending my kid out in the street looking any old way. I'm not going to send my kid out in the streets or into school, you know, not knowing how to speak, you know. I mean, yeah, we heard curses around the house, but you know that that's where it was, that's where you kept it, and that's it. And if mom or dad curse, it was mom and dad cursing. I wasn't the one that's supposed to follow right behind or say it out in the streets or say it to anyone else. You know, my parents were very strict, and you know, if we got out of line, you know, we got dealt with also. And I, you know, it doesn't necessarily take, you know, mom and dad in the household. Perfect example is Mace, and it's like, you know, seeing how his mom was, and Miss Mason raised us, myself, Pos. You know, it's like, you know, when we weren't at home with our parents, she was there making sure that we were in order. You know, so I could imagine how it went down in his house.
I grew up in a single parent home. You know, I come from a lot of the struggle that these rappers talk about. I've been on welfare. I've lived from house to house. I lived in one bedroom apartment, putting milk on a windowsill, and you know, regardless of all the trials and tribulations I've been through with my mom, my mother's my hero. You know, she struggled, and she struggled to really provide a good life for me and my brother. She did everything possibly under the sun to make sure that we've had a pretty stable life.
You know, after they put food on the table, they made sure that you held the fork the right way and, you know, you didn't stuff your mouth like
my head.
Yeah, that's kind of what molded us to be the people that we are today.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Dave and Mace of De La Soul recorded in 2000. Like De La Soul, Will Smith first became known for records that were more comic than hardcore. Under the name Fresh Prince, he started recording with DJ Jazzy Jeff in 1987, a year after they met in Philadelphia. Their second record, released in 1988, He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper, went triple platinum and featured the hit Parents Just Don't Understand. It won the first Grammy given in the Best Rap Performance category. Smith soon starred in the TV series The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and went on to star in such films as 6 Degrees of Separation, Men in Black, Independence Day, Ali, and most recently, Hitch. I spoke with Will Smith in 2001. Let's start with Parents Just Don't Understand.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand. I remember one year my mom took me school shopping. It was me, my brother, my mom, oh, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the Gallery Mall. My mom started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first, I just turned to my nose. She said, "What's wrong? This shirt costs $20. I said, "Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar." The next half hour was the same old thing. My mother buying me clothes from 1963, and then she lost her mind and did the ultimate. I asked her for Adidas and she bought me Zips. I said, "Mom, what are you doing? You ruined my rep." She said, "You're only 16. You don't have a rep yet." I said, "Mom, let's put these clothes back, please." She said, "No. You go to school to learn, not for a fashion show." I said, "This is a shot."
That's the Fresh Prince, Will Smith. Will Smith, how did you end up taking that direction in your early rap records and going the self-deprecating route and admitting that you had a mother? I mean, most rap records don't admit they even have a mother.
But, well, you know, really, I was coming out of the early years of rap music, which were less about being tough and more about parties. So, I mean, it was still out. What I was doing was still sort of out of place, but I was younger making rap records than a lot of the people that were my peers in the rap world at that time. So I was basically an old school rapper with a new school crowd. So the style was based on there was a guy when I was coming up named Grandmaster Caz, and Grandmaster Caz used to make his party rhymes, but it was always funny, and his rhymes always had a comedic edge to them. And essentially, I created my entire style after Grandmaster Caz. But I mean, he was as rare as I was.
Now, did the persona on that record suit your real personality? I mean, was your mother really taking you to the Gallery, the shopping mall in Philadelphia, and buying you the wrong sneakers?
You know, she's really good at a lot of things, but the whole combination of clothes with the shoes, yeah, my mom wasn't like the best at that. You're good at it, Mom, now, but oh wow, you're in Philly, right? Yeah, so yeah. My mom's going to be, okay, yeah, Mom, you weren't great at it, but you were good. But yes, it was tough some days, and it was even worse for my brother, because then after I was done with the stuff, he had to wear it old. At least I got to wear it new.
Well, how would you wear the wrong clothes to school? I mean, when you knew you were wearing clothes that you hated, mm-hmm. that your friends would hate too.
Yeah, that's
it.
That
would make you look
that
foolish.
Was tough.
Yeah, what do you do so that you can still not look foolish in spite of what you're wearing?
You know, you just hope that somebody else has worse clothes than you. So, you know, so then you can ride them. And I was always pretty funny. So that the being funny was a pretty good defense, because even if someone had nicer clothes on me, I could make the crowd think that their clothes were worse than mine just by the jokes.
Like what? What would you say?
Oh, God, anything. I remember when Haggar washable slacks came out. And that's, you know, if you called somebody's pants Haggar washable reversible slacks, you know, and you just, you know, you show them flipping them inside and out. They wear them one way on Monday and flip them inside out on Tuesday, you know. And if, like, you know, you act that out physically, then you could generally make people laugh with that.
Will Smith recorded in 2001. We'll hear more of that interview in the second half of the show as our Hip Hop Week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Drums, please.
Here it is, a groove slightly transformed, just a bit of a break from the norm, just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has gotten to be a little bit out of control. It's cool to dance, but what about a groove that soothes and moves romance? Give me a soft, subtle mix, and if it ain't broke, then don't try to fix it. And think of the summers of the past, adjust the bass and let the Alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run a rhyme, and put your car on cruise and lay back, cause it's summertime.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Posse!
We're listening to a track featuring De La Soul from Queen Latifah's debut album, All Hail the Queen. Coming up, Queen Latifah talks about rapping from a woman's point of view, and we continue our conversation with Will Smith.
Well, here comes the goy.
The
goy? The truth to the goy. You know the one, the eight of like boy. Stepping in a step step, keeping with the cap cap, making an appearance with a naughty headset. Lunatics, you lose because the plug's too saying. To the negative nods to make their weighing, way out of order. If you know your betters, you're better than your quarter. Wave the mighty peace sign higher than a kite. If you're feeling sick, it's alright, it's fever night. Don't go do-si-do and dig in no potholes, cause if you do, we call it Mars Patrol. It's no difference from the verbal last heard. Kayumbo is the ruler that's bond to the word. Moving more to deep feet, rocking with the knee deep. Dub is gonna leave you with a tweet, tweet, tweet.
Next on the menu, we continue with the pasta, dipped in chocolate, served with lots of Twizzlers and honey. Yum, yum, yummy lyrics, I'm flaunting, it's good for the tummy. Tip the waiter, now proceed to the floor, selling much records like a pit mover. Excuse me, mom, see pasta wins, cause I'm the A to the plug, W-O-N.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air, and we're featuring interviews with some of the most important DJs and rappers of the past 30 years. Let's get back to our interview with Will Smith, which was recorded in 2001 after he made Ali. He first became famous for his rap records under the name DJ Jazzy Jeff and The Fresh Prince. His rap success led to his TV series, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Now, you weren't from a poor family. Your mother worked for the school board. Your father owned a refrigeration business. Mm-hmm. Did it feel like it would be more authentic if you did rap records if you were poor? You know, because sometimes authenticity in rap has been equated with being poor.
Well, I mean, the neighborhood that I was from was, you know, working class neighborhood. I mean, it was we had our share of shootings and drug dealers, so I mean, essentially, I am from the same type of neighborhood that those people are from. I just had, I took a different approach. You know, it wasn't something that I embraced. You know, I avoided the drug dealers and avoided the dudes shooting craps on the corners and all of that. It just wasn't something that I chose to embrace, but it was definitely something that was a part of my neighborhood.
No, I mean, you know, so many rap records are about standing up to the police, and you know, some of yours are about standing up to your parents.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah, funny. You know, I mean, the thing is, it's like that's just not the aspect of my life that I was trying to embrace. I mean, as far as the run-ins with the police, I mean, I was 17 years old with a red IROC, so I had plenty of run-ins
right.
with the police and filed plenty of reports with internal affairs and reporting police and all that. I mean, the difference is that I always took the intellectual approach to dealing with the police. I know what the laws are, you know, police, you know, back then, the police, they had to have their hats on when they pulled your cars over. So if a cop got out the car and didn't have his hat on, I made sure he knew I knew he didn't have his hat on.
And how would you do that?
I'll say, excuse me, sir, I do believe that your protocol dictates that you have to have your hat on in order to pull me over, so you can go get that.
And would they?
More times than not, they would. They would call you a really bad name, and then they would realize that you knew something if you knew that. So their approach was a little less. It would be more verbally offensive, but a lot less potentially physically offensive.
You're really good with rhymes, and your recordings tend to tell interesting stories. I mean, they could almost mm-hmm. be a sketch. Mm-hmm. Did you ever write stories?
Yeah, when I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, I used to write stories about my friends, and I would make them superheroes, and I would sell them, their story, you know, Super Terry, you know.
what powers you want to give me?
Yeah, you know, that's what we would talk about, and we'd figure out what powers that you wanted to have and stuff like that, and then I would write a story where the kids were superheroes and, you know, sell them for, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. But I was doing that probably 12 years old to about 14 years old. I was doing that. My mother worked for the school board, and my grandmother was very much into education. So we were always writing and creating stories or reading Bible verses. We were always doing something literary.
Did you always have satisfied customers, or did your friends ever say, I didn't like the story, I want my 50 cents back?
Well, I would never, we didn't do refunds, but we would we would rewrite the story, you know, if you wanted a story adjustment. You know, I wasn't above a rewrite.
I guess that's good experience.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you can't get a cheese back.
So with your mother working for the school board, did she correct you a lot if you used improper grammar?
Oh yeah, we were.
Or slang in your speech?
Yeah, we weren't allowed to use improper speech. You know, you would run out of the house. And say, yo, what's up? What y'all about to do? And mother say, back in here, back. We would get on punishment for words like y'all, and you know, you'd be in the house in the middle of the summer crying. And my grandmother would come up and say, baby, you know a y'all is a boat.
did that irritate you, or did you think, oh, I'm so glad that she's teaching me proper speech?
You know, yeah, it was, you know, that was, yeah, 12 years old. Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right, Grandma.
You're right.
Proper speech. That's, no, it was tough. But that's something I've adapted in my life. I can't stop doing that to other people and to my kids. But I mean, very, very early, I remember that. I mean, it was just always important in my household to say things properly. I mean, in my neighborhood, kids would say, looked it. And my grandmother hated that, you know. You know, kids, oh, he looked it crazy. Oh, man. My grandmother hated that, and that was one that you'd almost get a 30-day punishment for that one. If you said something looked it like something, woo.
Do you feel bilingual?
Well, you mean bilingual in the sense of King's English and Ebonics?
Yeah.
Or English and Spanish?
No.
yeah, you know, there's a certain bilingual element that all successful blacks have to have. You know, you have to be able to you know, speak to the head of IBM in a way that gives confidence and communicates a sense of your commitment to excellence and perfection, and it all starts with language. But at the same time, you got to be able to relax and chill with your friends.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, no, thanks for having me.
Will Smith recorded in 2001.
On your mark, ready, set, let's go. Dance floor pro, I know, you know. I go psycho when my new joint hit. Just can't sit, gotta get jiggy with it. That's it, now honey, honey, come ride. DKNY, all up in my eyes. You got a Prada bag with a lot of stuff in it. Give it to your friend, let's spin. Everybody looking at me, glancing a kid. Wishing they was dancing a jig here with this handsome kid. Sick a cigar right from Cuba Cuba. I just bite it, it's for the look, I don't light it. Ill way to AMA on the hand, stay off late. Give it up, jiggy, make it feel like foreplay. Yo, my cardio is infinite. Big Willie style's all in it. Getting jiggy with it. Getting jiggy with it.
Coming up, Queen Latifah talks about rapping from a woman's point of view. This is Fresh Air. Our next guest on Hip Hop Week is Queen Latifah. Her first CD was released in 1989 and established her image as an Afrocentric, independent woman who didn't like the misogynistic bent of some fellow rappers. The strength that she portrayed in her music carried over to her roles on TV and in the movies. She was one of the stars of the TV series Living Single and has starred in such films as Set It Off, Bringing Down the House, Beauty Shop, and the musical Chicago, for which she received an Oscar nomination. I spoke with Queen Latifah in 1999 after the publication of her autobiography, Ladies First, in which she described herself as a young black woman from the inner city who was making it despite the odds. She wrote, she's lived in housing projects and in fine homes, hung out with drug dealers and with presidents. Let's start with her record, Unity, which in 1994 won a Grammy, an NAACP Image Award, and a Soul Train Music Award.
Time I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low. You know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring breath to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block. I had my cutoff shorts on right because it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes. Said,
who you calling a bitch?
In this rap, you talk about what you don't like about bitch and hoe kind of language. Elaborate on that for me.
You know, honestly, the record was really made in response to, at the time, there were so many records coming out with, you know, rappers calling women, you know, bitch this, hoe that. And I just thought it was, like, getting out of control. It was becoming a bit too much. And I'm not saying that I don't, you know, use expletives when I'm hanging out with my friends, you know. And, you know, we may say some of those things, but we say it in joking. But when it's meant to be really derogatory or to disrespect people constantly, you know, it just got to be too much. And so I felt like saying something about it, you know.
Did you feel that that language represented larger attitudes toward women in the music world or the rap world or among your friends?
Well, I feel like they represent certain, well, definitely some people use that word to apply to all women, you know. And it seems like the word, I mean, I could call a guy an MF, but it's not going to be as harsh as him calling me a bitch. It there's a difference. It sounds worse and it feels worse. You know what I mean? So I felt like, you know, it's time somebody says something about it, because it's still out of control. It's still out of control, you know, but I think that that helped bring awareness to it. And the record wasn't so much about the word bitch. The record was about, the first verse is about that, you know, the respecting a woman. The second verse is about abuse, a woman being beaten by her man and finding the strength to leave. And the third verse was about young girls, like, who wanted to be tough, wanted to be gangster bees, you know what I mean? I mean, the record was really about a lot of different things, and the point of the record was unity. Let's bring it all together. Let's put all of that stupid stuff to the side, and let's be together, man. Let's stop pushing each other away from each other, and let's be down with each other.
Now, the first name that you rapped under was Princess of the Posse. How did you decide on that name for yourself?
No, Latifah was my name. The Princess of the Posse was just my little title, you know? Because I was like the only girl in our crew, and Ramsey was kind of like, Ramsey and DJ Mark the 45 King were like the heads of the crew, you know, so to speak. They were like the heads of the crew, but I didn't go with either one of them, so I couldn't be like their girlfriends or anything like that. So I just took I was like the little sister. So I took the princess title.
So what was it like being the only female in your posse?
I wasn't the only female, but I was the only female rapper. It felt good. I was, you know, I was cool with it. It was cool. We had a big old family. We had a female DJ, this girl named Ginger G. She used to DJ. So she was the female DJ. I was the female rapper. And, you know, we had a couple of other people, you know, down with us, but that was it. And It was actually a good experience for me, because I got to be around guys and see how they think and what they do, and they could be natural around me. They didn't really hide anything, you know, in front of me, because it wasn't like I was their girlfriend, you know. I learned a lot, and then I had them right there to help me practice. We all practiced around each other. We were writing, and then we would bounce the rhymes off of each other to see what the other person thought and get constructive criticism. It was almost like a school for rap. It was real good.
How did you decide what you wanted your image to be?
I kind of just wanted it to not be like anybody else that was already out. So, you know, when the record company gave me some money to go shopping to take, you know, to get clothes and stuff for my promo pictures, you know, I didn't have a stylist, so they basically just gave me money to go shopping. So I went and bought, you know, a couple of outfits, but then I was walking down the street downtown in Newark called Halsey Street. And I passed this African store, and I had already decided my name was Queen Latifah by this point. And then I was looking at some of the clothing, and I liked the way that the pants were made. It was like a drawstring thing. It was beautiful embroidery. I saw this fabric, and I asked the lady, could she make me a suit, basically, you know, a shirt and some pants and a hat to match, like a crown. And she said she could do it, and she hooked it up for me, and it came out real cool. So I took my first promo pictures in it, and I was barefoot in these pictures, squatting with this African suit on, and it was like, whoa, who is this? You know, my look was just automatically different from then on. Plus, I was more open-minded. I didn't have to just wear, you know, sweatsuit and a gold chain and, You know what I mean? Everybody was already wearing that. I didn't want to be like everybody else. I wanted to be an individual. So considering the fact that at that time there was a lot of pressure on South Africa to free Nelson Mandela and for companies to divest, I was really conscious at that time of what was going on in the black community and in the world, African, as an African-American. So that would just fell right in line with it.
And tell me about your name, Queen Latifah. Not just Latifah, but Queen Latifah.
Well, initially the Queen was put on because I didn't want to be MC Latifah. Just back goes back to not wanting to be like everyone else. You know, MC Latifah didn't sound right to me. It just sounded, and everybody was MC something back in the day. So I just didn't want to be MC Latifah. I was like, man, that sounds corny. And I could have just left it at, my first single just says Latifah. So I could have just been Latifah. But I felt like I needed a little prename, a little, you know, something to go before that. And so I was like writing down all of these possible, this list of possible things and bouncing them off of my friend Ramsey. And I was like, what about Queen? What about Queen Latifah? He was like, yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. My mother laughed at me, but, you know.
that's her job.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, your 17-year-old daughter calls herself Queen Latifah, you're going to likely crack up a little bit.
When you started rapping, gangster rap was very popular. Did you relate to the stories of gangs and guns?
Well, we had gangs and guns, but not to the extent of that they did here in California. You know, it wasn't quite the same. You know, California has a bigger, huge culture of gangs out here. And we had, like, gangs, but see, gangs played out in Jersey and New York. It was no longer cool to be in a gang. So if it wasn't cool, then you didn't want to do it. But I could relate to it. But I had no idea, and everybody wanted to down gangster rap when it came out. Like people who, you know, so-called gangster rap or whatever, they wanted to down it and say it was so negative and violent and misogynistic and this and that, you know. But what it was real. What it did was inform the rest of the country of what was going on out here. And that was, to me, very interesting because I had no idea what Crips and Bloods were. I had no idea that, you know, there was this subculture going on in California that we really didn't know about. So, I mean, to me, the gangs kind of, you know, the guys kind of informed you about it. The rappers, they let you know what was going on.
Your father was a cop in Newark. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how you felt about the antagonism that was almost always expressed against cops in gangster rap.
Well, you know what? Cops here in California and cops in Newark, New Jersey are different cops. You know, you have bad cops everywhere, unfortunately. That's the reality of it all. But to me, you know, cops in New York and Jersey, it's like it's a good job. You know what I mean? It's a city job or a state job. You got benefits. You get to carry a gun. You know, you're not really trying to get killed. You're not trying to go to war with the people. You're trying to, you know, solve crimes and prevent crimes, but it's really just a good city job to a lot of people, and that's the reality of it. Out here, it seems like they really take their policing seriously. I've never seen an out-of-shape police officer in California, and that's kind of scary. You know what I mean? It's like these guys really work on their bodies and stay in shape. Like, you know, they're real serious about it, you know? I don't know. It's just weird. There's a different kind of thing. And I know my family is I got a lot of cops in my family, and I would hate for any harm to ever come to them, just because somebody was anti-police. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just as wrong as being a cop who brutalizes people.
We're listening to a 1999 interview with Queen Latifah. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hey,
Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Queen Latifah. Your mother taught high school for about 18 years. Is she still teaching?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to the high school where she taught?
Mm-hmm.
Was that rough?
For 3 years, my sophomore through senior year.
Was that odd having your mother be a teacher in your school?
Well, it was odd when you're trying to cut class, yeah. It's hard. You get busted too easily. Actually, I cut a lot, considering she was in the building. No, it was cool because my mother is like that teacher that everybody loves. Every student loves Miss Owens. You know, Miss Owens is so cool. You know, you get pregnant, you go talk to Miss Owens. What should I do? You know, you somebody pressuring you to have sex. What should I do? You know, any little problem, she has so many students come to her to talk to her, guys and girls, that really respected her opinion and just loved her and just felt like she was just so cool and down to earth and youthful, you know, that they could relate to her, but they could trust her as an adult at the same time to help them with whatever situation they were in. It was cool. You know, I got an extra coat of protection because she was my mom.
What was your mother's reaction when you told her you were dropping out of college and you were going to try to make it as a rapper?
You know what? My mother trusted me. I skipped anyway. So I had a year to buy in my mind. You know what I mean? I was like, okay, look, I jumped the grade, you know, early in life so I could have this year off. I wasn't quitting college. I was just taking a break. Because I figured, you know, my first record started playing, the album was being worked on, and I said, okay, look, let me take a year off from school and just really dedicate myself to this music career. If it doesn't work, then I go back to school. I'll be 18. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If it works, then I'm going to keep pursuing it and pushing it and trying to build it. And luckily for me, it took off. You know, my first album almost went gold. It sold like over 400,000 copies. Plus the single sold pretty decently. And I toured a lot. And, you know, I had a little lucrative career going on to be, you know, all of 18 years old. And, you know, my mother was, you know, helping me out financially, like, you know, to save my money and put it in the right places. And so it worked.
How old were you when you started calling yourself Latifah?
I was 8.
That's really young to decide you want to change your name. What made you want to do that at such a young age?
I didn't want to change my name. It was kind of a nickname, you know? Everybody did it. I was a follower, don't you know? No, where I'm from in Newark, it's like a lot of people pick up Muslim names. They don't pick, you know, like Pee-wee necessarily and JoJo and Junie and Junior. And you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, I guess, I don't know, maybe there was like a big surge of Islam in Newark, in the city of Newark, basically, and that which is like the Mecca of the area of Jersey where I'm from. So I think that like after the riots in 67, probably when, you know, they had some riots in Newark in 67, and then they built all of this public housing they had to, like, you know, give to the, you know, black people in Newark. I think Islam may have been like bigger. It had gotten bigger, so we kind of inherited all of these names because a lot of people that, you know, lived around me, older people, had Muslim names. I don't even know if they were all Muslims, but they had Muslim names. I wasn't even Muslim. You know, I was a Christian. I wasn't nothing yet because I really didn't choose till I was about 11. But I just liked the name. I meant delicate and sensitive and kind, and that was me on the inside. Even though I was bigger than most of the girls my age, I was really a sweetie pie on the inside. And so that was really reflective of me. And my brother and I and my cousins all did pick our name, so it just kind of worked like that.
In one of your records, you say, "Latifah's on vacation. I'm just plain old Dana today." Do you often feel that way?
Yeah. I do have to put Latifah on because, you know what? Latifah is me, but then she became bigger than me, you know, because Queen Latifah is known at all these places, and everybody doesn't know what Dana really does, you know, who Dana really is. So I have to give the you know, professional stuff a break and just be me sometimes, you know, and that's when I just jump in my car and drive and go visit my people and all that kind of stuff. You know, that was what that was about. I, you know, just let's just be Dana today.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Queen Latifah recorded in 1999. Her latest CD is called the Dana Owens Album. Our Hip Hop Week concludes tomorrow. Today's edition of Hip Hop Week was produced by Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
We'll kick it, the rhyme, it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister dope enough to make you holler and scream?
Yo, let me take it from here, queen. Excuse me, but I think I'm about due to get into precisely what I am about to do. I'm conversating to the folks who have no whatsoever clue. So listen very carefully as I break it down for you. Merrily, 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 high for happy overjoyed. Please, with all the beats and rhymes my sisters have employed. Slick and smooth going down the sound, totally a yes. Let me state the position. Ladies first. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah, there's gonna be some changes right there.
Believe me when I say being a woman is great to see. I know that all the fellas out there will agree with me. Not for being one, but for being with one. Cause when it's time for loving, it's the woman that gets them sworn. Stepping, strutting, moving on, rhyming, cutting, and not forgetting. We are the ones to give birth to the new generation of prophets, cause it's late.
I break into a lyrical freestyle. Grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles, cause they see a woman standing up on her own two.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And from Warner Home Video, presenting Alexander, Director's Cut, introducing Oliver Stone's final cut of his epic film, available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we conclude Hip Hop Week with the RZA, co-founder of the Wu-Tang Clan, Questlove of the Roots, and Mos Def. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.